the title of these proceedings, it has to have a title, Radical Theology and the Gospel. Okay? You haven't got it on yet. Good. Boy, I hate whoever has to annotate these notes. I know my others. Some of you may have been present this morning, others not. I noticed that there were a number of people who had spoken to me around the village about wanting a final session that were not there this morning because of conflict. It's the reason we're holding it again tonight. Essentially, for those of you who have just come to the village recently, I've been here 6 weeks and I've been lecturing off and on about radical theology. Current theological movements of various kinds, but of course the name particularly attaches to the Death of God movement. I've also gotten away from that because it's boring to talk about the same thing all the time. I talk about philosophy here and there, Camus, poetry, and so forth. But this is designed specifically to help with some questions that people in the village from time to time have expressed to me privately. That is, what is the relationship of radical theology today to the gospel? What can we say about this? You hear a great deal of emphasis about here about the gospel, as would be expected. And of course, the churches still claim to be proclaiming the gospel. So what are we to say to this? First of all, there are usually two things that we could say about radical theology. From those who feel that it is unwarranted or unwise, or who are scandalized or who are frightened or who are perhaps ignorant of what it says, we have the impression that it is proper to state it in this fashion: radical theology versus the gospel. And I'm concerned to discuss with you this evening a second proposition, which comes from those who have responded to various emphases or others within the radical movement, and sometimes perhaps out of ignorance too, that would state it this way: the gospel, therefore, radical theology. And this is the line of country that I would like to explore with you. Now, first of all, I think in establishing something like this, we need to find our terms. We need to know essentially what we're talking about. And if I talk in relatively abstract terms, it's because it's a very big subject, and that's the only way we can cover it. I hope they're not obfuscating terms. They don't keep you from understanding what we're talking about. The gospel, essentially, is the apprehension about life that man is not complete in himself. Essentially, what the gospel holds, and the gospel, of course, is found not only in the New Testament, and not everything in the New Testament is gospel, although we sometimes refer to it in general as gospel, but also includes portions of the Old Testament as well. And the gospel, or good news, is that man, while not able to complete and fulfill himself, can be completed or fulfilled by God. This is essentially it in the last analysis. Now, there are many thinkers, and there are many writings, and there are many traditions that lie outside of Judaism and Christianity that incorporate something preparatory to the gospel. This is not an apprehension. This is not a belief about man and the universe that is limited to Christianity at all. It is the manner in which the problem is solved that is unique. Let me say something about that. Philosophy, by and large, and theology, in the most general sense, is a popularization of a philosophical position, has explored man, his inner self, his mind, his expectations about himself, his understanding of himself. It has asked questions that are simple and seem childlike and yet are basic and are their essence of wisdom. Who am I? Where have I come from? To where am I going? What can I hope? What expectations can I reasonably entertain about myself and the world? Where are sources upon which I can draw to live? Now, there have been a variety of answers to questions like that. There have been a variety of questions asked that are different from this and yet reflect essentially the same thing. To say, what can I hope, is roughly the same as saying, what can I believe? to say what sources are there upon which I can draw is to say in a very general and abstract way, what forces or what powers, what spirits are there in the world, in the universe, upon which I can depend. It is largely speaking a philosophical way of putting the doctrine of God. Now, a number of great thinkers before the Christian tradition and parallel to the Christian tradition and the other great religions of the world have answered the question, at least preparatory to the gospel, let me say the preliminary stage of the gospel, in roughly the same way the Old Testament does, that man is not able to find within himself the final resources. He is not able to find within himself the final satisfaction of his questions and for his own life. Man is like a bolt thrust out into the darkness of the universe. Man is like a ball hurled through the sky. Man is suddenly, so to speak, in existence. He does not understand completely how he came to be there, nor all the conditions under which he lives, and he cannot finally have full knowledge about where he is heading, or what shall be the upshot of his life. And a number of philosophers, a number of thinkers have said roughly what the gospel holds, that when man searches himself, when he looks at himself, when he develops all the character and all the characteristics and nobility, when he stretches his mind in almost inconceivable ways for the finding of knowledge, for the seeking after strength, finally, as wonderful as human character might be when it is so developed, it does not complete itself. But to use a term used by one of the philosophers, it points beyond itself to something else. Now the distinction in the gospel according to the Christian religion is the modality of the answer. That instead of saying, as some systems have held, that we can have a dependence upon the universe, our dependence in Christendom is upon God. And in this we share the Jewish tradition. This is as old as the prophets, and even older. The distinctiveness of Christianity is not upon its dependence upon God, but that the answer to the questions raised in human existence are to be symbolized for us. They are to be seen in the myths, in the legends, in the stories, in the pictures that surround the coming of Christ. Christ, in a sense, is the gospel. It is the life of Jesus. It is not any theological doctrine. It is not any beliefs other than that, that Christ himself is the gospel. That the answer is indicated in the life of a man. And that this is full and this is sufficient. And this is all that is necessary. This morning I was in a much better case because I had a blackboard and I could draw a little parable. It's like this. The gospel is simply this. Man searching, man, and of course so many of us search, you know, without trying to first find the answer in ourselves, and it's a pseudo-search, and our religion is relatively sham, I would think. But man, when he develops himself, when he is a master and a steward of his own life, still finds that the full and complete and satisfactory conclusion of his existence is not within himself. It points beyond him. And as a philosopher, I would think, whether we say this is point towards the universe as a whole, of his points towards God, the language is roughly the same. The distinctiveness of the Christian gospel is that the answer is indicated in the life of Jesus Christ. Now, that is the gospel. Let me state that to this gospel, there is no exception from the standpoint of the radical theologians. None whatsoever. But that it is precisely on the basis of such a gospel that man does not find his satisfaction, his completion within himself, and that it points beyond him, and that the symbols of this pointing beyond himself and the symbols of the answers which are fully satisfying and do complete a man are to be found for us in the story of Jesus. This is why it is Christian atheism, as it's sometimes called facetiously. It is in the life of Christ that we find this indicated answer. It's starting from that point that the critique arises, which can lead to some rather exceptional statements that God is dead, that the church is dead, that we must abandon traditional theology, that a theologian can only work outside the church, and all these statements are made, and all of them have validity, that we must search in the midst of the secular, hoping to recover the transcendent, which is forever cut off for us now at our point in history. That if the sacred is ever to be known, it will only be because we immure ourselves in the world and that we go through the secular order. We will not find it in the traditional patterns and ways. Now, why is this so? We have a particular problem in discussing this, and I think a particular ignorance and hardness of heart to overcome with Lutherans because of something that is both factual and supposed. Factual in that it is true that in the Lutheran tradition, which is a kind of ancient Protestantism, you have the proper form of the words for discussing the gospel. It is pseudo or supposed because the proper form of the words are no guarantee that one believes the gospel, one lives the gospel, or that it makes any difference whatsoever to it. That is also true of Protestantism as a whole, that it contains and it bears the gospel in something approximating the proper form of the words. For my part, I found that many Methodist theologians better express the gospel in its purity than Lutheran ones do, including ones who are now living, some of them are best friends. So we are not the sole repository, I might get that footnote in here, for even the proper form of the words of the gospel. And others, including Catholic theologians today, are doing as good or a better job in many respects. But now the difficulty, and where the cookie crumbles, as the young people say, is this. And I have to back up and I have to take another line of explanation to tell you what I mean. Having the proper form of the words of the gospel and knowing it intellectually and having a loyalty to it is not the fulfillment of the kingdom of God. It is not even being Christian. It is perfectly possible for a communist philosopher to know the proper form of the gospel and to understand evangelical theology, and there are many now living it too. It is perfectly possible to admire it, and one might even believe that there could be a person who was an atheist in the strictest sense who would feel a deep sense of loyalty because he was Norwegian or German and his mother was a Lutheran, to these things. These things I say not hypothetically, but because I know people just exactly like this. In a way, each one of us is such a person. Having the proper form of the words is a dangerous thing. Everything in life, and this is my backing up now, my footnote, everything in life that is good contains power. Everything that contains power is, of course, subject to be useful. But everything that contains power can be destructive as well as constructive. There is nothing that is in the universe as a whole that cannot be as evil as it is good. St. Augustine saw this very clearly long ago, the primary foundational Christian theologian, that the holier something is, the more possibility of its becoming radically evil. It's seen in the scriptures itself, where it says in parenthesis someplace that Satan likes to disguise himself as an angel of light. We know that St. Peter, at least, or the Peter's tradition, knew that this was true when he talked about the judgment of God beginning at the doorstep of the church. That which is good can be misused, and that which is best can be misused worst of all. It is a contention of those who entertain radical views out of a sense of outrage, out of a sense of shame, out of a sense, yes, of rebellion and revulsion, that the gospel, the proper form of the words, has been demonized and misused. And it has been demonized and misused most cordially and most often by those who hold to it most loyally. Hypocrisy is always with us. Ignorance is always with us. We're not talking about simple hypocrisy. We're talking about the misuse of the finest, most perfect message that man can have. We're talking about something that's been turned in another direction. Now, I don't know how much I should go into. This morning we discussed some of the manifestations of this, where that which is finest becomes the most odious thing. You remember what Shakespeare said about roses and decay. In our Lutheran tradition, we've had several particular forms of this. Pietism is one, quietism is another. Legalism of the gospel variety, I would call it, is another. Parenthetically, I will back up here and say again, some of the theologians have suggested we declare a moratorium on talking about God, which I think is a reasonable suggestion. I would suggest that in the Lutheran church, more particularly, we ought to have a moratorium on talking about legalism and works righteousness. Part of the demonization of the proper form of words of the gospel is that anytime in the Lutheran church you talk about a good work, a doing something constructive in society, you're immediately assailed preaching works righteousness. Jesus Christ is the worst sinner in the world, according to this understanding of Lutheran theology. Well, pietism, I might hasten to add, because it's fashionable to condemn it, is a good thing in its way. None of us would be here, probably, if it weren't for the pietists, because it was the pietists, by and large, in our tradition that came to America. By and large, they were the ones who could not get along. And they could not get along because they entertained views about morality and the church and so forth that made it uncomfortable to live in human society and in the societies of Europe over the last few centuries. There's nothing wrong with piety. Pietism founded itself in Holland. It founded itself in other countries out of which our church came gradually over a period of time. On the basic insights of Luther, which were only Pauline, they were not new with him, that it was not necessary for a man to go into the monastery or a woman into the convent to make himself pure or to make himself holy and pleasing to God. But that is, it said over and over again, both in the Presbyterian and the Lutheran tradition, the cobbler at his bench, the shoemaker, the watchmaker, whatever it is, the dentist, laboring at his profession can be the light of God. He can be in communion with God. And more, he can be God's agent of benevolent service to his fellow men. There is nothing wrong with that. Our pietism, unfortunately, was cut off too early. It became rank in us. The pietism that founded the foreign missions of the Lutheran Church became perverse, and they are perverse in their manifestations, because they transformed themselves into what is known as quietism on all too many cases. And this, of course, is not limited to our tradition. Other traditions had quietism, too. Quietism sounds like Quakerism at first. And there's a great strain of quietism in the Quaker religion and some of its manifestations. But Quakerism made a better job of piety and quietism than the Lutheran Church did. Now, I won't go into that now, but it has a great deal to do with the political makeup of the Holy Roman Empire and of the conditions in Germany in the 16th and the 17th centuries. But essentially, quietism came to be exclusively a view of the relationship of the average simple Christian to the state and to what we would call sociological and political questions. And that relationship was perversely and demonically expressed in this way, that it does not matter what the state does, it cannot touch your soul, and therefore don't be concerned about it. That there is something slightly illicit, at least it is less than becoming to a holy Christian to dabble in the affairs of the state. Leave it alone. Whose is the rule? His is the religion. Whatever God has ordained is right, and that's an end to it. And it concerns me that I hear this still said in a day when we should have learned by now that the devil can get charge of a government or a program in society, and that we are only adding our names to the condemnations of those who die either directly or because of their neglect by the rule of such individuals. Stand back. It is our souls that are important. It is our holiness that is important. Or, as you can see it most clearly in some of the German sects, the Dunkers. You can see it in the Amish, You can draw a little box of holiness and piety about yourself. Symbolize it in dress. Don't wear buttons, you know. Don't ride in cars. And the hell with everybody else, because this is what you're doing. This is a demonization of the gospel. For the gospel, and now back on the main track again, says that in the ultimate question, man is not complete. To use the theologian's term, it is eschatologically true that man needs God. It is in the question of his final aim and goal that he cannot save himself, to use the religious language. It is simply not true that the gospel says, therefore this world can go to hell. Now the gospel very definitely say that this world is a mingled place. It is a place that indeed is under the power of the prince of the air, under Satan. It's a place that is in evil, in error. It has suffering. But it does not say, therefore, let it go to hell and we'll be snatched, as it were, through the world and forget about everybody else. Rather than that, I think if we see that the gospel is Jesus Christ and not a theological abstraction, that Jesus Christ walked through the world and tried to do something for the people that were in it. If there's anything else, and it's very possible, humanly speaking, that Christianity would not have made a go of it as a religion. Franz Kumont, one of the great historians of religion, said a long time ago that if they had to make a toss-up of scholars who had all the evidence in hand at a certain period in history, which would become the religion of the West, Mithraism, the worship of the Persian hero Mithra, or Christianity, we would have picked Mithraism. It was a better religion all the way around. Christianity did become the religion of the West. If it had not, Jesus would still perhaps have been remembered as a healer of men. But that is what he was. And salvation itself, the religious concept, is based on the root that means to heal. For it is the final eschatological, that is ultimate healing, that he performs, as it is said in the theological language, that he reconciles man to God. He completes man. He's a healer. It is a perversion of the gospel to think that his healing is only in that eschatological mode. It is worse than a perversion. It is blasphemous to think that when we believe we have that ultimate healing of salvation, that we are then excused from stewardship for the world. I think it says in the Bible, where is your brother? I'm certain that the last judgment, according to the parable which was told, which is not to be taken literally, but it sums up the way Jesus looked at it. There's no question there about what your faith is, or what your tithes were, or where you went to church, any of the other things that we think are important, but it states it in a very particular fashion. Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you before the foundation of the earth. For I was hungry and he fed me, I was naked and he clothed me, I was thirsty and he gave me a drink, I was sick and I was in prison, and you visited and you comforted me. He said, my God, when did we ever see you in any of those cases and ever do anything like that to you? And so far as you did it to one of the least of men who are my brothers, you did it to me. It was pride. It was not an eschatological witnessing kind of religious thing involved. It was a simple stewardship of the world, which is open to us to complete and to master. The world that begins within ourselves and extends throughout the universe. Simple stewardship of love. A new commandment I leave with you, that you love one another. And for those who did not make it, not on the basis of some supposed prevenient decree of God that a certain amount of people have to be damned or they're not worth anything, but he says, come you perished and enter the pit of fire, not prepared for man, prepared, it says, for the devil and his angels. Why? Why did we have this coming? I was hungry, you didn't feed me. I was thirsty, and you did not give me to drink. I was naked, and you gave me no clothing. I was sick, and I was in prison. And you neither visited nor comforted me. Even the eschatological healing, the final completion, which the pagan philosophers themselves knew was not in man, even that is dependent, if we can take the life and the words of Jesus at face value, even that final salvation is dependent upon our life in this world and the stewardship of the world for our brother's sake. This is not contrary to Lutheran tradition. This is what Martin Luther said, that this is not the preaching of the Lutheran Church, and it is not the action of it all too often. In the presence of the preaching of the pure words of the gospel and the lives of indifference and the hostility towards the problems of the world and the ignorance of the true causes of things that we run across too often, I for one can cast no stones at those who say that God is dead. I remember, and I know these men personally, Altheis is telling me, you cannot live down here. This is when Martin Luther King was on the chain gang. And you cannot stand and listen to the bishops proclaim we must have order and none of this business about marching. You cannot hear the preachers preaching at the Ku Klux Klan rallies, which they do. And you cannot see the Christian church indifferent or turning people away from the church because they're black and say that this God is living, this God is dead. Idolatry is perhaps the oldest of human faiths. It is as possible to make an idol of the gospel and to turn the true God's image into a lie as anything else. Romans 1 tells us it is a natural thing to do. The radical theology, therefore, comes because the gospel is true. It is not against the gospel, but it is against those who say the proper words of the gospel to make it into a lie and know no more about the Christ they profess than their lies indicate. That's all.
But who is there that doesn't make a lie of the gospel?
No one, but the question is, what is the thrust of your life? There's a difference between making a mistake and making a practice of mistake.
And institutionalize the lie.
Yes, that's the problem. I don't like to talk about that because, you know, it's too easy to attack institutions, and I'm doing that because we know we have to have them. The question is, of course it is true that it's perverse and compounded through history by institutionalization, but the only answer is, of course, to keep reforming the institution. I left one part out that I should have mentioned. I think a good watchword for us is the word of Schleiermacher, who was one of the first of the modern theologians, German Reformed pastor. He said, the Reformation must continue. I think that is involved. It is when we stop reforming that we start decaying. And he meant, as I mean, not the Reformation of the 16th century, but the Reformation continual, moment to moment, that must go on in anybody that is alive, anything that is living, of which the 16th century Reformation, of course, was 1,000 years late and consequently cataclysmic because of that. We may very well be coming to a revolution that will be worse than cataclysmic because we have put off reforming for so long.
John?
Yes? Yes.
In terms of, people use the word gospel, they say the gospel of prayer.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote a book by Kierkegaard called,
Gospel of Despair?
Of Despair.
Yes.
I mean, how can despair be a gospel?
Well, of course.
To me, this is a complete mixing of terms. And this is where I have had a strong fight with the whole, let them talk about a doctrine or a statement, but not to use the word gospel, which means good news. And it's never good news to be told you are to be good.
Yes, but
it's
I think that's
good news to me.
Well, that's part of our hang-up as Lutherans, though, because well, it's preeminently ours. It isn't that we don't want to be, you know, good any more than anybody else, but it's the words that get us. You see, we've been born and bred, and in this I'm as much as the next one, with the proper distinction between law and gospel, which, quite frankly, many times in our tradition has been and is pushed to a perversion of what even that means. Of course it isn't good news to be told, you know, you're pretty bad and you need to be better. The only way the good news comes in is that there is an indication of remedy. And that's exactly why I tried to give the gospel an abstract interpretation here, and to mention the fact that it is used in a loose way. It's used in one way that isn't so loose, but it isn't accurate either, and that's to refer to the entire New Testament. And then, of course, it's used to refer to one or more or several books in the New Testament. But actually, as good news, as evangelion, or as the announcement of the solution to man's problems, if you wish, it revolves around the simple declaration, which doesn't come out of the gospel itself, but it comes out of law, it comes out of philosophy, that man plumbs himself and he does not find the full answers to his questions.
I don't think that's true, though.
Oh, yes.
But that's not the New Testament.
Yeah, but the thing is, the New Testament is the answer to the problems that man finds. And that is the completion is in God.
But I mean, I understand the New Testament in its totality as being God reaching out for man. And the way I feel about this whole approach, Schleiermacher and the whole group that follow him, is that man is, you know, gradually reforming and going, needing more and more help, of course, because of the complexity of society. But I still have a feeling that we're reaching out, rather than the good news being that God cares enough to really come down and motivate me. Because I frankly would not be at Holton Village if it were not that cheap.
Yeah, but this is the thing. I believe that it's just a question of what language you're using.
Well, I think because, you have to be very clear on language.
All right, then we really should be. And the first is, Mary, we cannot continue to talk about God's reaching down. Oh, that's exactly what's implied in the language that I was using.
Yeah.
We cut off communication immediately.
Chasm or a break.
Right. And we must express it from the human side first, because we talk to people as human beings. Mm-hmm. And indeed, if they're not Christians, we have to talk to them on the natural level, to talk in theological language.
Right.
When a man is aware that he is not the final answer to his own question, so to speak, or when we become aware that we do not have the sources to live in the world as it is within ourselves, and that our own beings point beyond themselves, which is a way of saying what the doctrine of the image of God in man says. In fact, it is exactly what it says, without getting into a lot of things, what is the image of God and so forth, but that there's a hunger in it. I myself, in a poetic way, like St. Augustine's statement, which is just as unavailable, I'm sure, as your language at that point, but it means something to me for peculiar personal reasons. Lord, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they rest in thee. And it wasn't only Augustine the Christian who said this. Plato knew it. Most of the ancient philosophers pointed out it is present in the Oriental religion. Now, the question is this. What is distinctively Christian about the gospel? What is distinctly gospel about gospel is that the answer is God. That's first gospel. And that is present in Judaism too, you see, in a preparatory way, in an indicative way. Jesus completes. He does not bring something brand new. What is distinctively Christian is, and if you'll notice, this is exactly, in some ways, it becomes almost a caricature in some of the radicals. In fact, I'm sure it is a caricature in at least one. The distinctively Christian motif of the gospel is that the answer to your question is discoverable in Jesus.
Christ.
Jesus Christ. But
now, the thing I dislike about just using the term Jesus is that this is a common, I mean, this Robinson uses this too. And
I think we have to, though, because it is only in our tradition where so much is made of putting Jesus and Christ together.
Well, then you have to drop the Old Testament.
No, you don't. It is Jesus who is the Christ.
Yeah.
Which, although it doesn't mean this etymologically, is what it means by practice. He's the Savior, the healer.
He shall save the people.
He's the Savior.
This is what the name Jesus means.
Exactly. And so to say Jesus the Christ means the one who is the healer, one who is the Savior, so to speak. But now, too much was made of this. As you undoubtedly, many of you do know, there was a long and ugly history of contention between Reformed and Lutheran clergymen and theologians over when could you apply Jesus to Jesus and Christ. And if some of you remember your Latin, they talked about the communicatio idiomatum and so forth, which, in my opinion, is a bunch of BS. I think if you'll see it, if a lot of souls were saved out of that, I'm sadly mistaken. I said this morning, Mary, which is a horrible thing to say. I can only say that I do it as a renegade theologian of 5 degrees. 4 of them are in theology in one way or the other. Probably what is wrong with the church is theology.
This I agree with. Absolutely.
And I think that if we would take this, that the gospel now, in its particularly Christian sense, is Jesus, it's a simpler effort, and we would stop at that point, I believe many of the perversions would immediately wash themselves away. For this reason, when we deal with an abstract theological doctrine, we can draw some pretty ridiculous distinctions sometimes. But beyond that, that's just simply intellect. We can draw some pretty disastrous conclusions from the standpoint of Christian love. We can draw out dreadful things like double predestination. We can draw out some dreadful mistakes like quietism. But I think if we stuck to the simple record, it would be relatively impossible to do so.
But it's very standard, though, John, don't you find in the Gospels, that there's nothing that makes you feel as miserable as far as not measuring up.
This is fine.
Your relationship to the same Jesus who is so simple.
All right. That's
simple myself.
Well, no, I mean by that simple is apart from the grand doctrines of prophet, priest, and king, and so forth, and the two natures and all of this business. I mean simple in that sense. But now what you simply illustrate is this, that you see, gospel is an indicator of something rather than being a content. Of course, Jesus' words and can take on the characteristics of law, that is, demonstrating to us the futility of certain things. And I've tried to stress here, as I believe every theologian does, first of all, we must be aware of our need. But now, whether or not we are miserable, I wonder whether it's very important. Well, I mean, I don't know if it's such a bad word or not. It's a good word if you're really disturbed. I think and I am sometimes, very often, I think the gospel in it is this, that there is a solution, it lies outside yourself, and the indications of what the solution are to be found in this man.
But how do you find the man? Because it seems to me that the relationship to the scriptural account of Jesus is rather casually dealt with, and I don't really know. I mean, how do people ever relate to this Jesus?
Well, apparently they do.
I don't recognize Jesus in me.
Yeah. Well, I think that is where the wins. If we have 2 or 3 nights, we go on and say that's exactly what is necessary. But you know, this is the interesting thing. It is. First we have a hand, yeah.
One thing that I bother about knowledge is the sense that there is no good in me. And
No, we didn't say that.
No, well, this is what you're saying. I need to have people recognize Christ in me. One thing that I'm discovering in myself, and I feel Christ tells me this, and traditionally I've been taught it wasn't so, that there's much good in me. That God made me, and I am good, and I can be good, and I can be loving, and Christ says, go thou and do likewise, and I can.
This is
what repentance, you know, to me means is to turn around and start living.
That's why I said about first you have to explore yourself and fulfill yourself. Blow it up as big as you can.
But really, the good in her is not her, but Christ in her.
I don't know.
That's one of the perversions.
And then you have no new creation.
No. You
I'm
have
part of God's creation, and I'm good.
That's right.
Yes, but you think, you say you're part of God's creation. Well,
yes.
Good, but there is a new creation in the Christian.
Certainly, but it's eschatological. Mr. Lehman's a theologian and wants to say something. Dr. Lehman. Well, okay. I beg your pardon. Brother, you're a philosopher too. Okay. It saves a lot of hearing about that.
Very fascinating discussion about one thing you want to say.
Sure.
I start out with a few simple questions I want to ask you. But let me just make a comment on this and then ask my question. I think one thing that's happening right now is two things that are really being confused with one another.
Yeah.
One is the notion of good in the sense of a thing successfully doing what it is constituted to do.
Right.
In other words, if I scratch my nose and my finger gets here, my finger works good.
Okay.
And that is non-ethical. And in this sense, you are good. To the extent that your body functions the way it ought to, that you're able to survive as a human being, and so on, this has nothing to do with ethics. In another sense, where we are concerned about praise and blame, then we're getting into the area of ethics. And this is another sense of good. And it's very easy. And a great many theologians make this mistake, and I'm sure John will understand me. Theologians very easily slip from one to the other.
That's right.
Okay.
And they jump over from one to the other, and then they got trouble.
But
yes.
I'm not willing to say that because I don't love my brother the way I should, therefore I am not good. I am no more all good or all bad.
You are.
Yeah.
Well, you're getting into a difficult problem here because...
I'm imperfect.
From a non-moral standpoint, the divine intention was that we're putting together certain in my view that naturally would be this way. And this was the good that you were constituted to be achieving. This was the good of man. This is a non-ethical good. It's in the sense that an automobile is good if it works right. If there's something wrong with it and it doesn't work right, it's no good.
There's an ethical sense,
at least I've gotten through the church, that tells me that my every intent is evil, and that basically I'm rotten at the core. And you know, I don't believe that any longer. I really don't think it's true.
That's not good.
This is unfortunately the way the doctrine of original sin comes
false.
Over.
I think that's
it's
false.
It says that the intention is perverted, what would be a closer description of the original doctrine. But let's put it this way. What you're talking about, Aristotelian good or completion of the task and so forth, and that's fine because I would like to use that. I think we often neglect that, not the all, and we should. But of course, the ethical and moral...
The doctrine of the Father.
That's right. The doctrine, though, moves on, of course, in human beings to the moral and the ethical of nature. For this reason, whatever decision is possible, then we must speak of ethics. And here is the thing. You gave the hypothetical case, I don't love my neighbor. Now, I'm not all bad or all good or something. Now, I would say this could be treated both from this more basic thing of function, of fulfilling oneself, of growing. I used this morning the illustration of the flower, because I like that the flower opens up the sun and gives life and so forth. In a very real way, we could say that if we don't love our neighbor, or in some way we are confused or at odds in our relationships, we are not good, even in the fundamental ontological sense, because the dimension of love is perfectly natural and open to man. And if we don't reach it, we have perverted by our freedom our fulfillment. Just as I'm sure you know that in some cultures the feet were bound on women or their lips were stretched and they were distorted out of all shape. Something as natural as the growing or not growing of an organ in a very real way, because man participates in the spiritual dimension of sociality and of communion with other people. If he doesn't love his brother, we could hold it from that point of view. He was not fulfilled. Indeed, Aristotle does that. He writes at length on friendship. And all of this was passed over in the church fathers and in the Christianity because it's simple human wisdom. But now, on the question of morality and ethics and with Christ, I believe what the doctrines, and there are many of them, is a very complex question, fully intend is this, that ultimately the completion of this love is imperfect unless we know the secret, the open secret, that God forgives and that God completes, and that our love is imperfect. So, as St. Thomas Aquinas puts it, grace does not pervert nature, but it completes it. And one of the things I think that Lutheran theology and Protestant theology as a whole has done, its particular demonization, whereas the more Catholic tradition has had its too, has been that we have separated nature and grace. We have separated this and forgotten this. So there are several levels. But now to say because it is possible in human beings who have the dimension and the possibility of making choices and freedom, that they're all evil, and as some of the Psalms do say, you know, all the intentions of the heart and so forth are evil, to hold that as being a doctrine is itself demonical, because we forget that those Psalms were written in particular human situations by men who were confessing their sins and who felt that way about themselves, and for whom it may have been a fairly clear assessment about their characters at the time, as it might be about us at some time. But to hold that and to spread that for the whole human race, no. I think the final answer to this breast beating on the part of our false piety is the good, strong Jewish Old Testament, which has plenty to say about human perversity and evil, but it said about the creation, the one thing in there that is really gospel too, God looked on it and was very good.
But in other words, we have to put something to pull our words.
Yeah. Feuerbach was very good on that. He says, I'm not concerned with worms, I want men. No, of course not.
I would deal with them as evidential
or indicative is the word I'd
use. For the first group, Christ is dealing with people that do not believe that they ought to be going to heaven, and they do some evidence
that they
want
to talk. Right.
In other words, it was not what they did that caused them to go to heaven, but this was evidence of the fact that they were good people, even though they didn't think they were. In the second case, I'm dealing with evidence that justice the damnation to the individual, so that the individual understands why it's in there.
Yes, I would have used the word indicative if you hadn't introduced that. That's perfectly fine. Yeah, there's no conception here of being saved by works, but there is the indication that one has found his completeness. In other words, those people had found their salvation at that very moment. In the very moment, you see. They had actually completed themselves. The transactions themselves were complete. So that this is simply a declaratory thing that Christ is talking about here. And of course he is talking in a parable. This is not to be taken literally, but it indicates something. That we find, and this ties in what we were talking about, the completion or the fulfillment of our human potentiality. They had fulfilled their highest spiritual potentialities in the moment that they entered into this kind of what we can only call Christ-like relationship with other people. This is what they had found. This was that surprise by joy that Lewis talked about.
Can I explain a simple way of hearing him about it? They might have horrified that somebody would give you the Christ on it. You probably have to fix John's gospel if that's the case.
Yes.
John quite literally says, within the Trinity, all three of us are probably the same spirit.
Coming dwell within you.
I've learned a lot from some Roman Catholic nuns who, I don't know whether this is generally the case among the religious, or most of the religious Roman Catholic Church, or whether it's among certain nuns, or whatever, but they quite literally talk about being Jesus Christ in learned of him as fellow Christian and then enriched themselves by seeing him at work in other people. And so I personally would hope that people could see Christ in me. Well, he talked about, you know, living for me so that people may see your good works and see the power.
Greater works than these you shall do. That's
why you would glorify the Father. In other words, they, as pagans, would see you acting and would see that someone was at work in you.
That's right.
This is true. You know, I agree perfectly, and I agree with John on this, but the only thing I don't agree with is that I feel, since this is sort of a lateral relationship that we're having with each other, that is the result of a vertical relationship. And it seems to me that the whole approach has been moralistic, and that instead of seeing that Christ came down, and Luther himself says, you know, you can be Christ for one another. This is as far out as you can go. I certainly don't believe that this is not a possibility and a reality for many of us at times. But to feel that this is, you know, that this is the way somebody else is going to grow simply by being nurtured by seeing Christ in me, I don't think this is true.
No, it will never come if it doesn't come in that way.
No, but it's got to be an extra.
No.
I can't believe that my personality can preach the gospel. Because, I mean, usually my personality comes along to the other person because he says, oh, I wish I were as nice as you are. I mean, I'm not always arguing.
No. I don't believe it. This is of course commendable in its humility, but we realize very definitely, I think it was Wilhelm Hermann that remarks in his little Communion of the Christian with God, which I recommend to everybody to read. Unfortunately, it's out of print. But Wilhelm Hermann was Tillich's teacher, he was Bultmann's teacher, he was Barth's teacher. He's one of those little unknown figures whose true piety and genuine scriptural learning and philosophical acumen stands behind some of the people that have kept Christianity going as far as it has gone in this century. And he said, I asked myself, where do I see Jesus? And he says, I see them. Unfortunately, he's able to say back there in 1890 something, sometimes we feel we can't say, but he says, I see them in the people standing around the church door. I see them in my grandparents. And he writes a complete book on the Christian's communion with God, and he thought he was against mysticism because of the school to which he belonged, but he was not. This is the way it happens. This is the way it happened if we will read early in the Gospels and we will look and we will see. This is the way it's happened in our lives if we'll look and see. And I think that if we, out of a desire to be humble and to be rigorously honest with ourselves, because we all know the unlovely features of each of our personalities and the offense of our personality, this is the way that an incarnational theology must proclaim it.
But what do you preach?
Well, I think you're allowed to run here and say that I agree with you that something else has to happen after the act of what we might call Christian love, you know, an abstract of Luther Christ being with, of a neighbor being Christ to his neighbor. That,
I know what your problem is now, go ahead.
It's this, that Mary. After I have expressed and been loving or been Christ-like in my human relations, all of them, then somebody has to announce, so to speak, what has been going on, rather than that the announcement suddenly becomes the going on.
That's very good.
Yeah,
it does go against, in a sense, though, the surprise of those people in that judgment story, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the knowing. I think it corroborates this, because this is exactly what Christ said.
But at the end
this
of
time, this has been happening, you didn't know it was happening, but it is.
And the effect, you see, is what's important, the upshot, rather than the announcement.
And the not being often doesn't come from the person that's doing it. The thing is, I think you're really quite unaware of the fact that you're doing any good.
Well, I don't know, Mary, I don't want to really argue with you at this point. I think that argument has been used to demonize though too much, you know, and excuse us from doing anything.
Yeah.
Let me say that something must be said about the fact that Christianity is an incarnational religion and that it believes in a manifestation of this gospel in this particular man at a particular time. And a statement that somebody used as an argument against me the other day, which is scriptural, which actually I had to turn against him. There is no other name given under heaven whereby we must be saved than Christ. These other things, these proclamations, these things that we would like to hang on to, may not be necessary in the order of salvation, if I can talk the theological language that I'm not really familiar with anymore. They may be our desire to make sure that you know that this is being done because I'm a Christian, or this is Jesus doing it. And that isn't important. I don't know that that's so important. Even the resurrected Christ appearances, you know, didn't know who he was until the breaking of the bread. Never told them.
Yes, but it was just this that brought the name through.
That's right.
When without it would have been incomplete, would have accomplished nothing.
That's exactly right. Just the announcement would have been incomplete.
Yeah.
And what I have been trying to say, maybe around Robin's barn, is that we have announced without the power. Another thing, but one thing more, and I see three hands. The problem is when we say, when we are being little Christ our neighbor, I do not intend, nor does Altizer, whose theology I have expounded to you tonight, you might take that amiss, thinking that he just is an atheist or something. It is not our being little Christ in some imitative sense that we're talking about. We're talking about the communication through us of a living spiritual presence. We are talking about the mystical body of Christ, which is the foundation and the root of the radical theology. The living Christ. It isn't us doing it, but it is this spirit which communicates himself. And so in one way, you know, we can forget about everything and let it all go. But in another way, we can't. Paul put that paradox very beautifully. He says, it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And yet he went on to say, I do more work than anybody else. It's got to be both ways. But it isn't just the effect of our actions, because we can all be more or less aware of the limitations of our strength. What we are afraid to do is to turn ourselves loose and allow this power to take hold of us. Power which is contiguous with life itself. It is a really living God who is living in the secular world. He's not off in the temple someplace, but he's here. And sometimes we're amazed, we find him among the crudest of people. Maybe sometimes it's only in the crude that he shows up by contrast. Now there's 1, 2, 3, 4 hands. First, this gentleman in the yellow shirt.
I was wondering, historically, how did it come about that Protestantism became hung up on this matter of works righteousness?
Because of the problems that undoubtedly were real at the time of the Reformation with the indulgence selling and the various penances laid on people because, you know, the confessional system. In other words, there's a historical reason for it. But that reason is long past, I think, particularly in the present with the reform of the church.
It's a response to the...
It was a response to a particular demonization of Christianity at that time. And it was well taken at that time. That it is not so well taken today, I think, a view of the Catholic Church would show. Did you want to say something, Bill? And then
yeah, I just want to add another comment before. Well, when Christ asked me, here's some of John's language, he was showing the signs to the first generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the sign remains an enigma to the big and without the locust. When the locust comes, the spirit comes with it, then the sign will make sense and then stand. So you have both sign and locust that operate with one another.
Yeah. perspective.
What is he talking now? Logos, that's
Logos means reason or word, and by this he would mean, I think, here, knowledge of Christ.
Understand.
Understand.
Knowing Christ.
Knowing Christ. Yes, ma'am.
A few minutes ago, Mary mentioned the phrase, people being miserable in a sense of being miserable in a sense of being quotation from a book by William Barclay, Letters to the Galatians and Ephesians, in which he quoted Carl Jung.
Yeah.
And his comment was, quote, psychiatrists who were not superficial have come to the conclusion that the vast chaotic misery of the world could be turned into the neurosis of emptiness. Men cut themselves off from the root of their being, from God. And then life turns empty, inane, meaningless, without purpose. So when God goes, goal goes. When goal goes, meaning goes. When meaning goes, value goes. And life turns dead on our hands. I'm just wondering what you thought of.
I think it's perfect. That's exactly what we've been talking about tonight. God is the meaning of our lives, speaking from the Christian perspective. And indeed, I have my own interpretation of what the phrase and the experience of the death of God, because it's an experience, not just a phrase, means. It's in my third book, unfortunately, it won't be out till October year, but it is the fact that God, in the traditional Aristotelian Thomistic language of the West, is no longer able, those doctrines and symbols, to convey the meaning of life, and therefore using them keeps us from finding any new meaning. Indeed, that vision of God has died.
I have to say one more thing in answer to this lady's question over here. Edgar Casey said that our soul is a part of us that has never left God. I just wondered what you thought of that.
I don't know what to say to that. It's real old language, you know. We don't talk about souls and that sort anymore. I would say, if he meant that that's the aspect of man that is possible for the spirit to work through, I'd say yes. But it's a more complex than we can handle right now in a few minutes. It has a good understanding, I would think, of it. You could give it that. I think it could become very perverse if we pushed it too far. Yeah.
Doesn't Bonhoeffer say something about good works, or something about good works having some sort of causal sort of thing? That is, in a sense that I've heard people say that, for example, that I don't feel within me that I should become involved in the world's problem. You know. And so they tend to sit tight until they feel this way. And it seems to me I read something in Bonhoeffer, an encouragement to go out and try it.
Yeah.
And maybe in so doing, something will happen. I don't recall
the passage either, but it's probably good advice. And in the doing of the work, it will become clear to you. It's scriptural.
And the feeling or the lack of it has nothing to do about the efficacy.
At this point, that's right. Although to be done out of a good will is the perfect expression of morality. Yeah.
I was interested in this lady here who expressed this. I've heard many new Lutherans who come into the new Lutheran church are somewhat overwhelmed by the somewhat negativistic preaching. I mean, you come out, and I've heard one person express that you're continually lashed with God's love. And
that's
so
right.
If you come out of church with a spiritual inferiority and you can't do anything because you think you're so worthless.
This is what I've called
the
perversion of the gospel.
Yes, and this is
that's
where
right.
We have to get our balance and get the positive.
The proper
and,
form of the words and doctrines
know.
Can become
so
a new law.
I agree
law.
With you.
Yeah.
It's this emphasis on the negativism and the terrible guilt that we are raised with. Somehow I feel I don't want to give that guilt complex.